May it please the Court, my name is John McAllister. I'm here for the appellant, the Retirement Board of the NFL Player Retirement Plan. Based on undisputed evidence of Delvin Williams' employment and substantial earnings from July 1993 to July 1995, the Retirement Board of the NFL Player Retirement Plan denied his claim for retroactive total and permanent disability benefits during that two-year period. The District Court, however, held that the Board abused its discretion in denying this claim. This Court has confirmed that the arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion standard for reviewing discretionary employee benefit plan determinations requires District Courts to uphold decisions that are based on substantial evidence in the administrative record, even if there is contradictory evidence in that record.
Is this one of those plans where we do not give as much deference to because of the... I know there are some ERISA plans where we are less apt to give deference because of a conflict of interest.
I believe you're, Judge Kaczynski, I think you're referring to the apparent conflict of interest test. This plan is
You guessed right. That's what I'm referring to.
This plan is a collectively bargained plan. It's was formed by the Players Union and the NFL Management Council, and
it has representatives from both sides.
It's a jointly trusted plan. Has three members appointed by the Players Union and three members appointed by the NFL Management Council. This court in Ely versus Boeing has held that collectively bargained plans are not subject to conflict of interest analysis. This was also confirmed.
So, according to Healy, this is a kind of plan that gets full ERISA deference.
This gets a highly deferential review by a court, both the court below and this court. This court is instructed that a plan administrator does not abuse its discretion unless it, one, makes a decision without any explanation. Two, makes a decision in a way that conflicts with the plain language of the plan. Or three, makes a decision based on clearly erroneous findings of fact. Here, the district court failed to find that the retirement board had abused its discretion in any of the three ways I just mentioned. Instead, the district court based its reversal of the retirement board primarily on the timing of the board's request for employment evidence in this case. The question that we present to this court today is how could the district court reach this result, awarding Mr. Williams total and permanent disability benefits during a period when he was working and earning a substantial salary? The answer to that question is threefold. First, the district court misunderstood, misapplied, and paid lip service to the highly deferential abuse of discretion standard. Second, the district court failed to keep the focus of its review on the retirement board's final decision in October 1997 and on all the evidence gathered in the plan administrative record at that time. Third, the district court, in effect, conducted non-deferential de novo review and reweighed all the evidence anew on its own with little or no deference paid to the board's weighing of the evidence. In particular, the district court deeply discounted or effectively ignored the undisputed evidence of Mr. Williams' actual employment and substantial earnings during the two-year period in which he claimed he was totally and permanently disabled from working. The district court also...
The plan doesn't necessarily... I mean, has, in two different ways, certainly the fact of employment could be relevant, it has to be relevant, and could be dispositive. But plan in two different ways seems to say that simply working to some degree is not necessarily dispositive, right? Because it has the substantial language and because it has specific exemptions for certain kinds of employment. Yes?
Your Honor, the substantially language was added in 1993 to the plan to confirm what was already to confirm the board's agreement with the case law, which said that total disability is not an absolute concept; it's the relative concept. We're not going to require utter helplessness before.
So it doesn't mean that he has to have not been able to work at all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Necessarily. Exactly. So we don't. So for both of those reasons, the simple fact that he was working can't be the answer, right?
Well, it depends on the extent of the employment and earnings. If someone is selling pencils on a
Suppose it turned out he was getting paid by the Chamber of Commerce to go to two events a year.
Your Honor, if somebody was that is something that's quite different from this case. In this case,
well, we don't know. That's the problem. The problem is that the board made no inquiry.
Your Honor, the board. What happened in this case is the board asked Mr. Williams what his employment history was during the period.
And he told you and he gave you a bunch of names. And he said, you want to know anything else? Call these people up.
Your Honor, in the district court's opinion in January 2001, the district court said, and this is under counts 1 and 2, which are both benefit claims, the district court said that the board had the discretion whether or not to contact these employment references, and that in light of the documentary evidence that Mr. Williams submitted that showed that he was employed throughout the period and earning a substantial salary, it was reasonable for the board not to follow up and contact these people. All that the board is required to do is to have substantial evidence in a case to support its decision. The evidence that the board got from Mr. Williams, including descriptions of his employment, his tax returns.
What kind of descriptions did they have?
Well, on his tax returns, Mr. Williams indicated that he was an executive with the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce, which was the employer he was with from January of 1993 through April of 1995. And he was earning a salary of over $50,000 a year. The ERISA does not require a full-blown investigation into all the circumstances. There's nothing in the plan that requires the board to find out every detail about the applicant's employment. What the board found here was more than sufficient to constitute substantial evidence that he was working and earning a substantial salary during the period in which he claimed he was prevented from earning a working and earning a substantial living. The district court also paid undue deference to an examining physician's opinion that was fraught with difficulties.
Well, counsel, you know, actually, I think you may be more anxious about that than necessary. I found it sort of baffling. I read the doctor's 1984 letter at excerpt page 241 to say that this individual is disabled only with respect to lifting, stooping, stretching, bending, prolonged standing, and walking, i.e., not disabled from sedentary work, including intellectual and otherwise. And then in 1997, he has the contradictory statements of he's remained the same, but, oh, by the way, he can't do anything. So it seems to me that even within his own doctor's letter, there is support for your position, and I was kind of curious why you were walking away from that.
We weren't walking away from that, Your Honor. I agree with your characterization of the evidence. The district court said erroneously, I submit, that his opinion was the same throughout, Dr. Harrington, that he was totally disabled in 1984 and 1993, even though Dr. Harrington never examined him in 1993, in 1995 and 1997. We're not unduly concerned with the medical evidence. We think that the primary substantial evidence in this case supporting the board's decision is the employment evidence. This is a case where...
Well, it seems like it dovetails perfectly with what the doctor said in 1984, that sedentary work would work fine for this person, and that's what he said.
I agree with what you're saying, Your Honor.
Got about a minute. Would you like to retain for rebuttal?
I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
We'll give you a full minute for rebuttal.
Pardon?
We'll give you the full minute for rebuttal. Okay, we'll hear from opposing counsel.
May it please the Court, Elliot Bean on behalf of Mr. Williams. First of all,
in the record is the last letter denying the benefits.
The board's final letter?
Yes.
Is that, begins at ER 1163. That's the November 10th, 1997 letter.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by responding to Judge Graber's comments. The 1984 letter by Dr. Harrington does not address the issue presented by the plan that we have here before us.
Doctors talk about physical condition. They don't talk about the words of a plan, but that 1984 letter is quite limited in its description of what he can't do.
The 1984 letter is responsive to the issue that was before the doctor at the time, and the plan criterion at that time was whether the former NFL player could perform any work. That was the only issue, and he said he can't perform such and such and such work. Under the new plan, it's a whole new concept, and we've heard a new definition of it today.
But I don't see what that has to do with the doctor's opinion. The doctor said he is physically capable of doing certain things and not physically capable of doing other things.
That's correct.
What doctors do. It's lawyers who decide what that means.
The new plan asked doctors and only doctors to say, was this former player substantially disabled from working? That's a whole new concept. Now, in the reply brief for the first time, and we've heard it again this morning orally, the NFL Retirement Board puts forward a new definition of substantially disabled, citing an 11th Circuit case, in which they basically throw out the meaning of the word substantial also. And the 11th Circuit case that they cite, the Helms case, doesn't support that. The point is, though, that they're saying that substantial doesn't mean anything.
What do you think it means, substantially disabled? Does it mean...
It's a clinical finding, a determination by an expert.
So it doesn't have to do with whether he can work part-time or full-time, or whether he can work in some jobs or not others, or whether he can work at a lower rate than he could otherwise, or what?
I think it's what Your Honor was saying earlier. It's a clinical judgment that this person suffers from a substantial disability, a significant one. It's like the reasonable man or person standard in the law.
Pertains to his physical condition, or does it pertain directly to some measure of his ability to work?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does it pertain to his physical condition, or does it pertain to is it connected in some economically to his ability to work as some measure of?
I don't think you can separate the two. The ability to work combines both a physical and a mental ability. It's a conclusion. Does this person's football injuries
to present that satisfies the standard? The doctor's letter doesn't seem to do it.
The doctor's letter addresses that specifically. The May 1995 letter says that the gentleman was substantially disabled based on his examination in 1995. Then in the subsequent letter by Dr. Harrington, when the board says and puts blindfolds over its eyes and says, well, we don't know what was the case back in 1993 or 4.
I'm sorry, you're saying that the doctor says he's substantially disabled, that's it? That's evidence? Doctors make that kind of determination.
That's what the form.
Even though he says, gee, you know, he can do sedentary work, he can do intellectual work.
The doctor wasn't addressing that issue before. The doctor, in under the new plan, and does address that issue twice in his primary report in May 1995.
But why on earth would we hand that decision over to the treating physician?
Because that's what was bargained for.
Gives the board wide latitude and substantial deference in making exactly that kind of determination. Why do we say that they're bound by the sort of vague determination by the statement by the
couple
physician?
Of reasons. That's what the plan means. That's what the plain meaning of the plan is.
The plan says he has to be substantially unable to engage in any occupation or employment for remuneration or profit. But it relates to substantially unable to engage to make a living, not substantially unable to walk or substantially unable to lift things. And I find it difficult to believe that someone who can sustain sedentary work for a reasonable compensation is substantially unable to engage in an occupation for compensation. It just is a non sequitur.
So what was he getting the 50 grand for?
We don't know. The board never found out, and the board had the duty to find out under Booten and other cases. But I don't think it's that difficult. I think the language of the plan.
Taxes on it, right? It wasn't a gift. And if he's out there doing things for which people can pay him compensation, why isn't that sufficient evidence under the broad?
I'm arguing against an empty record, which the board had the duty to find out.
Why is it that? That's the part I find most sort of interesting and troublesome. I.e., your client has to make out the case for eligibility for benefits.
That's correct.
And that includes both his physical condition and his whether he's substantially unable to work, right? And he provides some information about his employment, but he doesn't provide any information from which one could tell whether he comes within any of the exceptions, plus whatever this substantially means. I mean, maybe substantially means if he weren't disabled, he could make $300,000, but because he is, he only makes $50,000.
That's correct, and that's what the doctor is there to do.
But how does the doctor know the economics of it?
The doctor knows the capabilities of the person. The doctor can review what he's tried to do in the past by way of employment. The doctor makes a clinical judgment, not whether he's totally disabled from doing even sedentary work, but whether his football injuries have produced what in the doctor's judgment is a substantial or serious disability. And that was the judgment of this doctor. And the plan, I realize you asked another question about the record, but the plan, by the very use of that new term substantial, makes that a clinical judgment. And the only experts here...
Oh, somebody was a paraplegic, but was a history professor, and he could be a history professor even though he was a paraplegic. He would be substantially disabled, meaning physically impaired, but on the other hand, in terms of his ability to work, he wouldn't have a problem.
But it's not for us to make that decision. The plan assigns that to the doctor.
Plan. No, it's the plan
board,
assigns it to the board.
The plan assigns it to the board, and the board assigns it to these neutral physicians. If they didn't like the opinion that they got from their own neutral physician, Dr. Harrington, they say, well, this doesn't make any sense. The guy's worked for a couple of years, makes $50,000. That doesn't make any sense. What do? They just say, well, we're going to deny benefits. No, this is they consider it a medical judgment. You go get another physician. This is what's happened in all the other cases where a board is dissatisfied with a medical judgment or a medical opinion they get. They find it.
They're not dissatisfied. The doctor says.
They say they're dissatisfied.
He can do certain kinds of work. They have evidence that he does kinds of work for which he gets money, and he says there's nothing to be dissatisfied about. We're satisfied that this guy is not unable to perform work. I mean, so why, given the sort of broad deference which we owe under ERISA to the benefit plan, why isn't this more than enough?
Because they had uncontradicted medical opinion that this man did have a substantial disability under the plan, and because their reliance on the so-called employment history was irrelevant. It was just this bare fact of employment that Your Honor was talking about before. I don't want to interrupt you.
As I say, that's the part that troubles me the most.
Yes.
Leaving that aside for the moment, what it means to be substantially unable to whatever is an interpretation of the contract. They can't be handing that over to the doctor.
They've interpreted, until the reply brief on appeal, they've interpreted this as a medical judgment for their neutral physicians to make. And if they didn't like the opinion they got, they could have gone and gotten another one. Instead, they say, we don't like this opinion, so we just deny. Because we think the 1984 letter made more sense. And by the way, they interpreted that 1984 letter accurately. Just saying, what was his opinion about the man in 1984? So they make it a medical judgment. And I think that you're talking about, you know, deferring to arbitrators or what have you. I don't see how the courts can...
His physical circumstances hasn't changed since 84. That seems to be a given.
That's correct.
And in 84, he could do certain things but not others, and we interpret that to be that he can substantially work. That's what they're saying, right?
That opinion was for the doctors to make. I realize we're going around about that. But,
I know.
It's a question as whether they're... Their interpretation of the plan that any work is sufficient for denial is just not based on a reasonable interpretation of the plan. Sure, there's deference in a case like this. There's no conflict of interest under the court's precedence. But
Doesn't seem close to me. I'm sorry. You know, it seems to me that the guy's working. He doesn't have a physician who says he can't do anything. He's making money. And given deference, the board can't find no. He's not disabled. I still don't get it. I mean, I understand you have an argument, but I don't find it even close. I mean, you know, sure, if we're reviewing the novel, it would be a different thing. Maybe we come to a different conclusion. But this is the ERISA gives substantial deference to the plan. This is the kind of plan administrator that is not subject to heightened scrutiny. So the degree second guessing that we can do is really quite limited.
The ERISA case law uniformly requires some reasonable basis and some reasonable interpretation of the plan and some basic inquiry. And to go back to Judge Berzon's earlier question, the board told Mr. Williams how to carry out his burden of proof, which was to provide references. He did all he was asked to do. And under Bruton and other cases, if the board thinks that that information is not sufficient, they can't
Bruton.
Just stay in there.
I know Bruton.
I know you know it very well.
This is not Bruton.
I think it's worse than Bruton because they rely on an interpretation of the plan that's not, I think it's utterly unreasonable.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You have a minute for a bottle?
I yield.
Very good. Case is argued. We'll stand submitted.
Thank
we
you.
Are adjourned.